Hello, I'm Laura, and you're listening to Microviews, the podcast where Matt and I talk about some of the times microorganisms and microbiology have been in the news over the past month.
That's right, it's September already, and we're on our third episode of Micronews. Today, we're going to be discussing superbug sniffer dogs, how researchers in Nottingham are saving koalas, and following up on a topic we covered on a previous episode, the HPV vaccine. So Laura, what's your first pick this month?
I thought it'd be appropriate to start with a story that tells us a bit more about one of the earliest forms of complex life. Microbiology can tell us so much about the origin of life, and also it can be used to examine evolution and phylogeny, which is like a big family tree of all living things. Now, this story caught my eye because of the title. The world's first animal was probably a carnivore. Now that made no sense to me, because how can you be a carnivore if there are no other animals there to eat? Unless you're a cannibal. But I imagine any species wouldn't last very long if the only thing it had to eat was family members and potential mates. And also, they probably would have said that in the headline instead of carnivore. Anyway, I had to look further into this, and it turns out that carnivore is actually any creature that eats heterotrophs. Heterotrophs are organisms that don't create energy from sunlight like plants do. So this creature evolved 800 million years ago and ate things that weren't plants, like protists or other single-celled microorganisms. The researchers think that these early creatures were probably sponge-like and filtered their protist dinner out of the water by filtration. It probably evolved from something called a coanoflagellate, a protist from even further back on the phylogenetic tree, which swam around eating bacteria, like a tiny little mini carnivore. It's quite an interesting story for a number of reasons. I thought it was weird that this researcher described protists as meat, and it was cool to learn about heterotrophs. But really, the most fascinating thing about this research is that it contradicts what evolutionary biologists previously thought, in that the earliest life forms ate plants and other organisms that generated their energy from the sun.
You may remember, a couple months ago, I read out the story about HPV. For those who don't, HPV stands for human papillomavirus, and is linked to the majority of cervical cancer cases, but other types of cancers as well. Over the last 10 years, the vaccine has had a successful vaccination program immunizing teenage girls against the virus. And the story is about the vaccine now being offered to boys aged 11 to 13 as well. There is evidence that the vaccination program really is working. In the USA, they have had a very similar vaccination program, and a study found that between 2009 and 2016, oral HPV infection rates in unvaccinated men fell by 40%. The unvaccinated men are being protected by something known as herd immunity. As long as enough vaccinated people are around, they protect the unvaccinated. If you want to learn more about herd immunity, there is a great video on our YouTube channel. We'll leave a link in the description. Despite the vaccine being offered to boys, the Teenage Cancer Trust would like to see more. In a story published on the BBC News website, the TCT said that they want to see the vaccine free on the NHS to all men and boys up to the age of 25, as it is for women and girls.
So why isn't it being given to older boys at the moment?
The Department of Health and Social Care have said that it would only have a very limited benefit, as the older boys and young men are already protected by herd immunity, so it wouldn't really do much extra.
Oh, fair enough. Matt, did you know that koalas aren't actually bears?
Marsupial.
Yeah.
Mm.
They're cute little things.
They are. And they're riddled with chlamydia.
Well, I'm going to tell you a bit more about that. So researchers in Nottingham have found a genetic clue which may be able to rescue falling koala populations. Koalas in northern Australia are dying from a number of cancers, including leukemia and lymphoma. There are also really high rates of chlamydia, as you've just said, which affects fertility. This means that populations are really struggling. So there was some research published this month in the Journal of Medical Microbiology, which showed that a certain virus is circulating in Australia and is impacting on koala health in two very different ways. The virus is called koala retrovirus, or CoRV, and embeds itself into the DNA of the koala and becomes part of its genetic makeup. The viral DNA is then passed on to the koala's offspring. There are two main populations of koala in Australia, those in the north of the country and those in the south. Southern koalas have a smaller genetic pool, meaning that they're more inbred, but this has led to them being larger and fluffier.
Cute.
But they also have different versions of CoRV embedded in their genome, a version that actually protects them from chlamydia and cancer.
And the northern ones don't have that?
They have a different version of the virus, so they actually have a bigger version of the viral DNA in their genome, which means that they are more prone to getting cancer.
Wow.
Yeah. Same virus, same koalas, different effect.
So it's a small. So it's just a smaller part of the genome. It's in the southern.
Yeah, so in the southern koalas, the CoRV is missing a large chunk of its genetic material. There's something in this missing chunk that's making the northern koalas more susceptible to chlamydia and cancer. And they're very excited by these findings because it can hopefully be a game changer in the fight to save the koala populations in the north.
So that's actually really similar to my next story. Before I start the story, I must say that the research has been performed on mice and human lung cells. Researchers are not ready for human trials yet, but the research is still really exciting. Now, it's getting closer to winter and the threat of a cold is getting stronger and stronger. But the good news is that scientists may have found a way to stop this winter annoyance. Most common colds are caused by rhinoviruses. They mutate so easily that they are very difficult to find a treatment for, which led to scientists coming up with the idea of host-directed therapy. Rather than trying to change the viruses, we would change our bodies and make them inhospitable for the viruses. The theory behind it is that individual viruses can't replicate on their own. They're dependent on infecting other cells and using the cell's replication software to replicate themselves. Scientists use gene editing to turn off certain parts of the human lung cells, then expose the cells to different viruses, including the viruses that cause the common cold. Viruses were unable to replicate inside cells that had the protein methyltransferase SETD3 switched off. The researchers then created genetically modified mice that were unable to produce that protein. When the mice were exposed to viruses, all that had that mutation survived. In the story on the BBC News website, the researchers said that the plan isn't to produce genetically modified humans like the mice, but to temporarily suppress the protein and provide protection.
Oh, cool. And how do they suggest they do that then?
They're working on different chemicals that would suppress it, but they haven't actually figured anything out just yet.
And my last story of the day is about how changes in the environment can affect the spread of diseases. Changes in the climate can make places which were previously uninhabitable to certain microbes suddenly more accessible, giving them space to thrive and spread. Researchers at the University of California have predicted that climate change could double the reach of a fungus that causes something called valley fever. Valley fever is caused by Coccidioides fungi, which is usually found on the ground of hot and dry areas in the southwest of the United States. The fungi release spores after light rain, and if these spores are made airborne by wind or disturbance, they can get into the lungs and cause a pretty nasty disease. Initially, symptoms are similar to flu, which makes valley fever pretty hard to spot. In some people, the disease progresses and causes lesions that can be so bad that people have lost their limbs in the past. The fungus can also cause swelling of the brain, and about 1% of people with valley fever will die. The researchers are concerned that if the current trends of drought and rising temperatures in the southwest continue, the fungus will spread, bringing with it the threat of disease.
So, what are the ideal conditions for the fungus?
The researchers found that the areas with an average annual temperature above 10 degrees Celsius and less than 600 millimetres of rainfall each year has the highest rate of disease. 600 millilitres of rain is not very much.
No.
So quite deserty.
Whereabouts in the USA was it?
Southwest. So just like the wild, wild west sort of place.
Yeah.
Dusty.
That's kind of like the desert areas of like Colorado and places like that.
Yeah.
When you think of microbiology in hospitals, the first thing that comes to mind isn't normally dogs. But my next story this month contains a pair of truly remarkable canines. Hospitals have to deal with healthcare-associated pathogens, and one of the most well-known is Clostridium difficile, otherwise known as C. difficile or C. diff. The disease infects the bowel and causes diarrhea. It commonly infects people who have recently been treated with antibiotics and can easily spread, making it a real problem for hospitals. The bacteria can stay on a surface even after cleaning, so it's very difficult to know whether a surface has been properly disinfected, which is where the dogs come in. The dogs in question are a pair of Springer Spaniels called Angus and Dodger, and they work at Vancouver General Hospital. Their sense of smell is so good that they can sniff out odours from C. difficile even when the surface has been cleaned. Once they've sniffed out the bacteria, they tap their paws on the area they've smelled it and they get a nice treat to say well done. From May 2017 to October 2018, they performed 659 searches and sniffed out C. difficile 391 times. Hospital officials are careful to draw too much of a link, but the number of C. difficile infections in the last quarter of 2018 were the lowest of any quarter in the last 5 years. They found bacteria all over the place, and it may even lead to improved services in the hospital. For example, C. difficile has been found in toilet paper dispensers, so they may even redesign it to avoid the spread.
Oh, cool. But how do they know they've got rid of it if it can survive cleaning?
When they've sniffed out the bacteria, they fully disinfect the area with ultraviolet light, and that guarantees no more bacteria.
So from now on, could we have a dog squad in every hospital sniffing out a whole load of different superbugs?
That would be amazing, and it would make going to hospital 10 times better. MRSA is one of the other superbugs, and it's really problematic in hospitals, and they've got a third dog called Rudy in training to sniff out that superbug.
Amazing.
Obviously, it's been such a success, they're now like hoping to, other hospitals are saying, can you bring our dogs here? And apparently they love doing it as well.
Oh, they get treats.
I know.
And they get to sniff about. Dogs love sniffing about. That's their favourite thing to do.
So that's all our stories. But just before we finish, there's one quick bonus one that I'd like to mention because it caught my eye. Is that all right?
Yeah.
The 55th Wildlife Photographer of the Year competition has released some of the shortlisted images. I usually try to avoid seeing the images online as I want to see them in all their glory at the exhibition because it's at the Natural History Museum. I love it. But this year, I couldn't help seeing the amazing image of an unfortunate beetle that's been taken over by the zombie fungus. Now, the zombie fungus has a pretty horrifying life cycle. The fungal spores infect the insect where the fungus grows and takes control of its body. The then zombie-like insect is compelled to climb a tree where it locks itself onto a branch. And then, rather disgustingly, the fungus grows out of the insect's body and finally releases its spores, which float down, ready to infect more passing insects. The incredible image by the photographer Frank Deschendol was taken in the Peruvian Amazon and shows the fungus grown out of the insect, ready to release the spores. It really is a fascinating, albeit horrible image, and I would highly recommend going to see the exhibition when it opens in October.
Well, thanks, Matt, for that bonus story. And I think that is all that we have time for this month. As always, we'll leave the links to the stories in the podcast description below. Thanks for listening to Microbe News, the podcast from the Microbiology Society.